This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview Jake Ratner and Elena Stein from No More Deaths.
They've just come back from the Arizona-Mexico border. They bring with them horrendous stories of deportations.
In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we speak with attorney Azadeh Shashahani, who directs an immigrants' rights project for the ACLU in Georgia.
Thousands of immigrants are arrested yearly in Georgia and put in the pipeline to the Mexican border.
Stay with us.
Michael, this month marks the two-year anniversary of the Israeli assault on Gaza.
As the Electronic Intifada said in talking about this two-year anniversary, its Operation Cast Lead, when some 1,400 people living in Gaza were killed, slaughtered by the Israelis. As the Electronic Intifada said, not only were there dead people the result and huge costs, human and material, but truth and justice also took a huge blow. And of course, again, Israel was emboldened by the fact that the world really, particularly the United States, because the UN condemned it as well as the Goldstone Report, but the world really has stood silent for 2 years while war crimes were committed by the Israelis in Gaza. It's a sad moment for all of us that it's now 2 years.
And I think it's important to emphasize that nothing has changed in Gaza. The blockade is still going on. The Israelis succeeded in destroying the infrastructure of Gaza. 1.5 million people living in an open-air prison have no flour mill now. They've got no sewage. They've got no clean water. The Israelis have prevented any kind of construction material to be sent in. The Turkish ship that came with aid to the Gazans was attacked by the Israelis. 9 people, including an American citizen, were killed, some think executed. The only good thing I can say that came out of this is the Goldstone Report. Goldstone is an internationally respected jurist who nailed it and who said exactly what happened, that the Israelis attacked and slaughtered an innocent population. That report came out, and Michael, we have news on that report, don't we?
We do. My niece, Lizzie Ratner, along with Phil Weiss and Adam Horwitz. Phil and Adam are the editors of Mondo Weiss, an incredible blog. But the three of them are editing a fine book by Nation Basic Books called The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. We will have them on the air in the next week or so. The book will be out by mid-January. It's an amazing book. The introduction is by Desmond Tutu. Naomi Klein has a long piece in it, and many other writers, as well as important excerpts from the Goldstone Report itself. So while it is 2 years ago and international justice has not yet been done, Gaza is not and will not be forgotten. And I think this book will be an important contribution to eventually achieving justice for the Palestinian people and the people of Gaza. Michael, this is our first show of the new year. It's 2011, and we've been on the air how long now?
7 years now.
And we're growing, I wouldn't say like mushrooms grow in the dark, because we're part of the light. We have how many stations now?
Well, we've got 32 stations across the country, including this wonderful station, WBAI, which allows us to broadcast to thousands of people across the tri-state area. We have a website, lawanddisorder.org, which gets thousands and thousands of hits, especially after we interviewed Noam Chomsky. And we're flourishing, thanks to our listeners.
And we have Facebook.
Appreciate it.
I would encourage people to go on Facebook. We're getting hundreds of hits on Facebook. So we're really pleased with our listeners. We're pleased with the many comments we got. Actually, and speaking of comments, while it is a new year, we did get a comment from someone about why there may not be the kind of people in the streets with regard to the austerity plans in the U.S. while there's people in the streets in France, the United Kingdom, and Greece. And one reason he gave was that we have the Taylor Law here with regard to New York municipal employees, but I presume they have that in almost every state, which essentially says that public employees, which are a huge sector of the population of union people right now, cannot strike. It's illegal to strike if you're a public employee. So the fact that you get fired immediately, that you can get fired, it's a big damper on really the key piece of aggressive behavior that unions need to implement, which is strikes.
Hundreds of immigrants are pulled from their families and bused to Nogales, Arizona every day. The families are broken apart as deportees, most of whom have been working in the U.S., are left in limbo in this foreign city. No More Deaths, the humanitarian organization, is also stationed in Nogales to provide basic first response aid to deportees. Many immigrants arrive in Nogales after serving months in jail. Our two guests, Jake Ratner and Elena Stein, volunteered with No More Deaths and witnessed the sentencing process called Operation Streamline that funnels through a mass court proceeding immigrants who are usually sentenced up to 6 months in jail. Very few are allowed to explain their situation in court. The conversations that were shared with Jake and Elena reveal that as many as 1,000 detained daily deserve to tell their story. Jake and Elena, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
All right. You guys have just come back from Arizona. You were working with the group No More Deaths. And I know you've shared some of your experiences with us prior to the show. But this is really an opportunity and a chance to tell us what happened. What did you see? I know you went on both sides of the border. Just start from why you were there and what you did.
Well, we were living in Patagonia, Arizona, which is near Nogales, Arizona. But the border actually runs right through Nogales. And so we were working on the Mexico side of Nogales, providing basic first aid to those deported who come on buses and are dropped off in Nogales on the Mexico side.
Nogales has a wall right dividing, is that right?
That's right.
How high is that wall?
The wall is actually between 15 and 20 feet high, and it's this corrugated iron, corrugated tin wall that was actually built by the same company contracted that built the wall in Israel-Palestine.
I believe it's called Elbit Private Security.
So you see this wall, and it splits right down the middle of the city. So there's Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. And obviously, visually, the cities look completely different with crazy winding streets in Mexico and big, broad highways in Arizona. And you can look at this wall from any point of view, but from an environmental point of view, when the monsoons happen in Arizona, which happens for 2 months every year, the flooding comes down, comes from Mexico, and flows towards Arizona, towards the U.S., and gets stopped by the wall. So every year in monsoon season, 6 feet of water gather on the Mexico side, and there's these striking photographs that show both sides of the border, and there's nothing. There's a drought on the Arizona side.
So you guys are sitting down in Arizona. Give us a sense of you wake up at night, you go up, what do you do?
Right. So in the morning, we drive 20 minutes from Patagonia, Arizona to Nogales, Arizona. We take our passports and walk, push our way through a turnstile gate. No Border Patrol agents stop us and ask if we have any kind of documents or anything. But we just walk into the Mexico side. And as we walk in, we walk past a very long line of people who are waiting to cross from Mexico into the U.S. It's a striking image.
And there's some sense, are these people who have recently come? Are they people who are lived in the United States for a long time? How's their, what are they, what languages do they speak?
Most of the people who we come across have been living in the U.S. for a long time. A large portion of them have been living in the U.S. since they were children. Most of the others have now have families who are living in the U.S. Both genders are coming. We come across more men than we do women. But often their spouses are citizens and their children are citizens. So oftentimes these single family members, when they come, are in this very unique position within their families in that they're now separated not just from the work that they intend to do, but their actual homes. Families.
And they've been living in the United States sometimes for 10, 20, 30 years.
Exactly.
And they were brought here possibly as children by their parents.
Exactly.
What's the process by which a person like this is picked up in the United States and deported? What do they go through?
The process is different for each person. And the process is different in Arizona than it is in a lot of other places. Some people are apprehended by ICE when they're found through maybe having a broken taillight. They're pulled over by the police through the process of being handed over to the authorities. They get handed to ICE and then down to Border Patrol. Other people might even just get a knock on the door because there is belief that there is someone who doesn't have papers who might be living there.
Or we've heard stories of people who've had their workplaces raided by officials and then everyone in the workplace is deported. We've only been doing this for a couple months, but talking to other volunteers who have been doing this for years, this is a new phenomenon that people who have been living in the United States their entire lives, who have been living there 15 years, 20 years, are being deported. That's recent. That hasn't always happened. That's been happening more and more in the last 5 or so years. And so we'll meet kids our age, 20 years old. We met someone who volunteers all his time now at the soup kitchen. And he came to the United States when he was 3 years old with his family. Every single one of his other brothers and family members are citizens. They were all born in the United States. And he just happens to have been brought over when he was just a young kid. And now he is completely separated from his family, the same age as me, and unable to get back to the United States, to his family.
Well, how do you answer people who say, what's wrong with deporting these people? They're taking American jobs.
I think there's been more and more consensus recently that our economy is supported by immigrants, and if they weren't in those positions, they wouldn't be filled. Hmm. We now have, estimated 8 to 12 million immigrants living in the country, and they're working jobs that wouldn't be taken by others. They're very often exploited by their workers because of their lack of documentation.
To speak to that, there was a campaign put on by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW, as a brilliant kind of organizing tactic to answer that question of people who make that argument. And what they did is they ran a campaign saying, here, take our jobs, and they put out advertisements. Yeah, it's great. For the farm worker jobs in Florida picking tomatoes. They ran a two-month campaign, let's say, advertised saying, you want our jobs? Take our jobs. And no one responded. No one wanted those jobs. They're not jobs that anyone wants because they're back-breaking work. Picking the tomatoes and hauling those buckets, nobody wants to do that. They're exploitative.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a good answer. I want to go back to your border issue and what it's like and what you think about the way U.S. is treating people who were deported into Mexico. Do they have their possessions when they come over? Do they have their documents? What's the situation that you've run into in different circumstances?
One of the most frequent things that we come across are people who have had all of their belongings confiscated along their journey to the border while they're apprehended. And that means that their clothing is taken away, their money is taken away, and their identification is taken away. And that has some really serious consequences once they arrive in the foreign city of Nogales. Without clothing, they can't stay warm at night. Without money, they can't pay for a phone call home. And without ID, they can't even go to a Western Union and get money wired to them from their families because they don't have ID. In fact, without ID, they can't even go to Border Patrol and request that they get their belongings back because Border Patrol says, let me see your ID.
So what do you do?
It's part of the work that No More Deaths does. We can provide our IDs because we have the privilege of still holding on to our identifications, try to help people get that stuff back.
How many people are we talking about here, and why is your organization called No More Deaths?
In Arizona, the numbers are hard to exactly pin down, but say there's about 1,000-plus people deported every day in the United States, maybe 1,100, I've heard the figure. And in Arizona, that might be 300 or 400, a third of the people being deported from the U.S. going through Arizona. No More Deaths, actually, a lot of the work they do, we've been working with the specific part of No More Deaths that works with people who have already been deported. But a lot of the work No More Deaths does is to work with people who are crossing the United States, who are coming into the U.S. and dying along the way. Hundreds of people every year, one or two people per day, are dying, making the trek, going from Mexico and crossing in the desert in harsher conditions, increasingly so, into the United States. And so No More Deaths is called that because they believe that while the U.S. has a right to secure its borders in some capacity, there is no reason why the U.S. should be allowed to create conditions where hundreds of people are losing their lives trying to get
here. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously something's going on that's causing these people to have to come north. They don't want to. What's the economic forces that undergird this migration?
Well, there are a couple things to look at depending on how broad our scope is. The smaller picture that we're looking at is, and specifically to add to why it's No More Deaths and why these deaths have been on the rise. Since 2005, we've seen a number of initiatives from the U.S. that have increased border security. And these are Operation Streamline in 2005, the mass court process by which people are tried together, usually sentenced, entered into the criminal system in the U.S. We've seen the Secure Borders Initiative, which has been a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar initiative to create a second, stronger, apparently, border, and increase technology like radars and sensors and cameras, etc. We've seen Obama send down 1,500 more Border Patrol agents, and I think the number was something like 1,200 troops. There have been an incredible number of initiatives recently to apparently make this border more secure, or so we're told. The interesting thing to note from this is that we've learned that there have been no fewer people crossing since any of this, and no more drugs crossing since any of this. The change that we've seen is that more people are dying. The number of deaths from this year is up 23% from last year. And the reason for that is that with all of this supposed strengthening of the border, it's not as if there's a wall that crosses all 2,000 miles of the border. The wall actually only is along 700 miles of the border. And all of that equipment is only on 700 miles. So what that does is it forces people who are still going to migrate to go through the harshest parts of the desert. And that's where the deaths are occurring.
Why are people dropped in Nogales? I mean, are there other places where the U.S. deports people to? And how's it determined where people are dropped?
We've actually heard some pretty striking things about the location that people are dropped off at. It seems to be kind of as a way to deter people from crossing again, that whatever point of entry the person uses, whether it's on the east or west side of the border, they'll take them to the farthest point of entry that they can and drop them off there.
Leaving them, in other words, as far from where their homes are as possible.
Often.
This is deliberate.
Deliberate, absolutely.
Yes.
You mentioned, Alanis, the streamlining. Did you ever see that in practice, streamlining, when they sentence people? What happens in those?
Streamlining is a process that was started in 2006. It takes about, out of the 300 people that are caught crossing the Arizona border every day, they take about 75 people, and they take them into Tucson and put them in front of trial together in order to kind of face jail time, possible jail time. The U.S. does this, they say, as one of the main reasons being to deter people from crossing the border. If they know that they're going to end up facing jail time in the United States, they say that this streamlined procedure, which puts people in maximum in prison for up to 6 months, can act as a deterrent. But we heard someone make the excellent point that that's kind of a ridiculous idea, that people who have given up, you know, life savings, who have traveled often not even from Mexico but from countries like Guatemala and Honduras, who have made these incredible journeys, who have been forced economically, as Michael was alluding to, by circumstances to come to the United States, who have gone through this entire process of walking through the desert, it was 1 month or a 3 month or even a 6 month jail sentence, is that going to really act as a deterrent?
And actually, Jake asked the streamlined judge that very question.
Oh, yeah.
With the same emotion behind it.
So, Jake, you asked the guy the question, what happened?
Do you think this is really a deterrent?
And he said, I don't know, this is my job.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, there was one experience, I think you also asked somebody from North Carolina about this, a man who was sentenced, is that right, or South Carolina?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, you should tell it.
While we were in Nogales, Mexico, a few times while we were there, we got the opportunity to speak with a really wonderful man whose two young children under the age of 10 were still at his home in North Carolina. And they were unaware why he had left. He's been gone for 4 months from his home, and he hasn't had a chance to speak with them. Every time No More Deaths come by with a phone, he tries again to reach his children.
He was just snatched from them, is that it?
That's right.
By deportation, by ICE.
And he's tried working with social services and other child protection agencies to try to get these children in custody so that he can just reach them to say, here's what happened to me, I love you. But he hasn't had that. He hasn't been able to reach them.
You saw him in Nogales, Mexico, right?
That's right. So we spent a few different times while we were in Nogales, Mexico, talking to him, learning about his story, trying to figure out if we could get creative with how he could reach them. And on the last time that we saw him, he said, well, I'm going to go try to cross again on Saturday. I have no choice. I have to see my children. And we gave him hugs and said, keep us posted on what happens. A week later, we decided that we wanted to see the Operation Streamline procedure. And we walked into the courtroom. We saw 75 people chained from their wrists, their waists, and their feet, all waiting to go in front of the judge.
Are they chained together?
No, they're chained. Each of them is chained to themselves. But it's a pretty incredible thing because not one of them had committed a crime other than crossing the border.
Treated. People tried en masse or individually?
They're tried 5 or 6 people at a time. They are apparently given the space in court, as said by the judge, to explain their situation. But they're advised by their lawyers, lawyers who represent, 8 to 10 of them at a time, and who have 15 minutes to speak with all of them before this trial. And the lawyers do this daily, so they're...
It's just helpful to get a visual of this proceeding. It's this huge room, this very modern-looking building, and it's white walls, and the walls are smeared in this brown color of people who have sat against those walls day after day after day for the last 5 years, 75 people a day, and their sweat and from their bodies is just plastered to the walls, and they might try and clean it and stuff, but just the repeated process of sending thousands and thousands of people to fill the American prisons creates this visual effect that just makes you shiver.
Yeah.
And the whole time that the court proceeding is going on, the chains are just clinking away, and the sound of clinking chains from every one of them, from a chain around their waist and their feet.
Yeah, it wears on you.
Stand it.
While as we walked into this room and saw what Jake is describing, there was our friend, this man, who had tried to cross and been apprehended.
Yeah, and he's now bound for 6 months in prison.
That's right.
And then he's going to be deported.
That's right.
And this is going to deter him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not going to deter him. And Michael implied
right, exactly,
that.
Exactly. It's not going to deter him.
Because he has
he's
two
going to see his children.
Because his children are where now?
His children are in North Carolina. So this
yeah, but they're in North Carolina under what conditions?
He doesn't know.
But they could be put in a foster home or anything, right?
There's any number of things could be happening to them, and he has no idea. But part of the interesting thing about the process is that people are advised not to tell what's going on in their lives. They're told that unless they have extenuating circumstances, they shouldn't share. They don't have a moment to defend themselves. And apparently, we don't know any of their stories. We only knew this man. But his circumstances weren't extenuating enough that he could actually voice them in court. The only thing that happened was his lawyer said he would like to serve his 6 months as close to this city in North Carolina as possible. And the judge sort of said, well, I'll make a recommendation, but a recommendation is all I can make.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, the recommendations don't
we
mean
only
anything.
Heard a couple of people actually voice their stories.
Two out of the 75 people who went up there told their stories. And you can imagine if two people out of the 75 were telling their stories, what those stories are like and how completely horrendous.
I mean, it reminds me of the debtor's prison in the time of Dickens, you know, with the way you're describing it and what the results are. And, of course, just like prison didn't stop debtors, it's not going to stop people who need to see their children.
It's not only irrational, but cruel. How do you explain that this country has come to this position where these people are treated in this way?
In this specific instance, I think it's really important to just acknowledge the role that major corporations have had in creating this law, implementing it, and financing it. The CCA, Correctional Corporation of America, I think it stands for, wrote this law with legislators, but this private company sat down with legislators, conceived this law in a secret room in Washington.
This is the streamlining law.
The streamlining law.
Which puts people in jail.
Which can put immigrants, thousands of immigrants, for up to 6 months in jail. And wrote up this bill in secret, in a secret room. And then that, all literally with the same title, that law was the law, the streamline law, that was passed. Of course, you understand the economic motivations for this prison company doing it. They're getting money from taxpayers to fill these jails and profit off of Mexican citizens who are then put and held in the United States in prisons, financed by American taxpayers, doing the work, paid absolutely nothing while in prison and asked to run these prisons.
The average cost of keeping a prisoner in prison in New York State is $55,000 a year.
Yeah.
I imagine it's about the same for these Mexican citizens. So our tax money is going to these corporations to incarcerate mothers and fathers of children, many of whom have lived here for a generation. That's
what's remarkable
that's
is
exactly
that you're saying
right.
The corporations actually wrote the detention law.
Literally.
It's
I mean,
incredible.
That's amazing to me.
And that's then how they it
set
works.
And then they set up the prisons to house the people
right.
under these conditions.
The alternative that the U.S. government currently has to putting people in prisons, civil deportations, just deporting them. The problems still remain.
Right.
But what it shows is this is not a necessity. Operation Streamline and putting people in jail, it's not proven to be a deterrent. It was really interesting. The very last man who was tried in the Streamline procedure that we saw decided to plead with the judge. His story was, I'm sure, like many of the other people, it wasn't anything we haven't heard before. But he said, hey, I was... I came to the U.S. to work because I was trying to feed my family. And the judge said to him, you're going to get fed for the next 15 days. You're not going to go hungry. Can you say the same for your family?
What does that mean?
The next time you cross, you're going to get more time in jail, maybe 6 months in jail. You're going to be fed every day of those 6 months. Can you say the same for your family?
They won't be fed because he's in jail.
Exactly.
So there's no point to him coming across here because they're going to jail him.
Right.
But is that going to make, you think that's going to make any difference to him or the others you've spoken to?
I mean, he doesn't have an alternative. When? We have spoken to people who, after serving a lot of jail time, have said, I can't cross again for risk of more jail time. But those are pretty much only people who don't have families living in the United States. If you have a family living in the United States, almost nothing is a deterrent. People say, without my children, what am I living for? Who am I? As some of these people are coming from Central America as well. So after they've come through the Guatemala-Mexico border, which is even more ruthless and lawless than our border, and then come up through Mexico without any kind of identification, cross through the Mexican desert, and then cross through the U.S. desert. Like Jake said, saving up all their life savings for this journey. You think that Operation Streamline is what's going to deter them?
Can you give us some perspective on the overall picture? You've talked about Operation Streamline, what happens on the other side of the border, the removal of people to different points of deportation. But here we have a Democratic administration. Has there been a shift in what happens at the border, better, worse?
Much worse. As Elena was explaining before, the number of laws that have happened since 2005 with putting more money, tons, billions of dollars, into securing the border and expanding the wall and forcing more people into the desert just is obviously a much more horrific and inhumane situation. The Secure Communities Act, that is just outing people who have spent their lives living in the U.S. and the failure of the DREAM Act. And
what is the Secure Communities Act? Is the one that each community that cooperate with the local police or something? What is that?
The immigration cooperates with the local police, who are made into agents for immigration. And when somebody gets busted for a broken taillight, they end up in Nogales.
Right.
So you mentioned Secure Communities, DREAM Act. Talk about the DREAM Act for a second.
The DREAM Act is a piece of legislation that has been trying to get through Congress since 2001. It was created so that children who came here, I mean, it's been changed so many times since then, but most recently, who came here before the age of 16 with their parents, who then completed high school, could go through a process to gain eventually permanent residency and beyond that, citizenship. And they would need to go through 2 years of college or the military in order to get that citizenship. This was a piece of legislation that had widespread support because it was also going to be a military recruitment tool.
Yeah.
And yet it still didn't pass through the legislature. It's unbelievable.
Now, I'd heard that Obama had increased enforcement tremendously, in fact, almost doubling the number of people deported, as a way of showing the Republicans that even with the DREAM Act, we can be very tough. I mean, that's essentially what happened from what I understand.
Yeah, and that's one of the saddest things that I can imagine is when he sent more troops to the border and increased enforcement and then at the same time deported, as you said, two times the number of people that had been deported before his administration. For what? Especially now, he could have claimed maybe that it was to create bipartisan support for this act. Now that this act has failed, every one of the stories, as Elena was describing, of people we've met, each one of those 300,000 plus people who have been deported, each one has this story. And as we begin to learn the individual stories, it doesn't become a number anymore. It becomes 300,000 plus stories.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
One of these days, and it won't be long. You're gonna look for me and I'll be gone. I believe.
Just joining us, we're speaking with Elena Stein and Jake Ratner, working with the group No More Deaths in Arizona and in Mexico.
Yeah, it's heart-wrenching talking with each person about what they've been through.
Yeah, I want you to go back to that, because you mentioned when you met people at the center in Nogales, Mexico, in the buses. You mentioned no documents, sometimes no clothes, sometimes their possessions. Give us some stories about some of the people you've met and what you've had to do.
Sure. We talked recently with a 21-year-old man. He met us outside of the Comedor, and he noticed that we had some big suitcases with us full of clothes. And he said, hey, can I get a pair of pants? And we said, don't you want to eat first? And he said, no, I'll skip the meal. I want the pair of pants. There's a lot going on there. He doesn't feel like he can return home to his family until he looks a certain way. He doesn't feel like he can get a job in Nogales while he waits in limbo until he looks a certain way. He can't stay warm at night until he's clothed in a certain kind of way.
The services, just to add in, that are offered to people like him while in Nogales are very, very short term. So he can eat at the Comedor for the first few days only, having a stamped certificate saying that he was in fact deported. And after that, he can't have meals there. And the same with the shelter where he sleeps. He's allowed to sleep, I think, at the shelter for a week and then is no longer allowed to sleep in the shelter.
But he's been in Nogales for 2 months.
And so he's been sleeping on the street and trying to scrape up whatever money he can to feed himself.
This is a person who's your age.
This man is 21.
21 years old.
Yeah. He's a year younger than us. He's 21. Wow. And he has a wife. He showed us her picture. Looks like a prom photo.
She's in the U.S.?
Great. Yes, she's a U.S. citizen. And his baby, she's 10 months old. She's a U.S. citizen. He can't be with his wife and his child. His wife doesn't believe that he's been in the U.S. because he's deported. She thinks that he's gone off with another woman. And he doesn't have enough time on the phone to explain to her the depth of what he's gone through. This is something that an issue that many men face. And his child, we asked him if his child was crawling yet. His eyes welled up and he said, I don't know.
There were stories about possessions. What happens to people's possessions? They get taken away? What happens when they're like picked up in the U.S.?
Well, people's possessions are confiscated by ICE and Border Patrol at many different parts along the way. It's an incredible thing that happens. When people are sent to prison, they're told that they can reclaim their possessions within 30 days. But usually, or often, they're sent to prison for more than 30 days, for, 6 months or something. So they get out of prison and apparently all of their belongings have been confiscated. And their identification is kept for apparently as
record.
Or evidence. I mean, they can't photocopy the ID, but they have to just take it away. That puts them in an incredible position when they're dropped off in Nogales with nothing to show for themselves.
Elena and Jake, you've told us some of the stories of the people that you've met. And if you wouldn't mind, might I ask you a personal question, your stories? You guys are 22 years old, you're friends and comrades, you've recently graduated college, and what's the first thing you did? You didn't go to work for a corporation, you went down to the Mexican border to do some political work. What was it that led you from college down to the Mexican border? Personally, why did you want to do this?
It's an interesting question. We work through that one all the time.
Yeah, and I think we both have different answers. A lot of the work that we've done before has focused on Central or South America, either traveling there and being lucky enough to be able to study there, do some work there, and has always kind of had some pretty remarkable contradictions that come with an American going to a country with the intention of helping or doing some type of work, whether it's service or any other thing. And I think very quickly both of us found in our experiences that like we can learn from being in another country, but that it's not necessarily right of us to go there with the intention of changing or helping another country.
And I think, in fact, that a lot of the situations that we were seeing, a lot of the poverty, unrest, was a result of actions taken by the United States.
Where were you? What country were you in?
I've spent some time in a few summers in Guatemala and El Salvador.
Right.
And, of course, that's a really interesting place to go, motivated by the amount of poverty, and end up learning that, in fact, a lot of that exists because of our presence there.
What countries were you in?
I studied abroad in Havana, Cuba, through Penn, and I spent a summer living in Bolivia. As Elena was saying, that we, as citizens of the U.S., have created a lot of the conditions that have caused these migrations to happen, whether it's through NAFTA and trade subsidies, or whether it's more direct attempts through coups and other coercive measures that the U.S. military has done in many of these countries. And so I think both of us feel that there is a responsibility as Americans. First, understand, I think, the situation and understand the realities that people are currently experiencing every day as a result of actions that were taken by our country. And have a responsibility then, for after understanding it, to try and do something about it. And I at least definitely came to the conclusion that in Bolivia, where it's an indigenous revolution and they have kicked out the American ambassador and the DEA agents, and they want to do it themselves. And that's, I think, something that you have to absolutely respect. So working on the Arizona side and crossing into the Mexico border seems a lot more to fit our place as Americans as opposed to coming in into a different country.
Right. These are our neighbors. I grew up in a Redwood City, California, which is, probably half Mexican immigrants, either first, second, or third generation, and half white. My elementary school was divided into a Spanish-speaking class and an English-speaking class. We come from bilingual, multilingual, multicultural homes. That's the beauty of our country. Those are the beauty of our local cities and the broader place in which we live. I think we feel we have an obligation to have good relationships with our neighbors. I mean, Mexico, it's our neighbor. I've also had a few personal experiences that opened my eyes a little bit to what was going on the border. When I was 15, I went to Winsong Peace and Leadership Center, an incredible place in Patagonia, Arizona, which is actually the place where Jake and I were working alongside working with No More Deaths. And this is a program, part of the larger organizations of Free the Children and Meet a We, a youth-run organization. And among the many things that they do, young people bring other younger people down to the border to see what's going on and to build the leadership skills and the community-building skills to then go into a situation like the border, spend some time at maquiladoras, at migrant dinners, at border patrol, at co-ops, in homes, and try to get a sense of the situation. And then this was an experience that I had when I was 15. Then we came back onto the Arizona side, and as a group of 15-year-olds said, okay, what's next? We've seen that this is our country and us, not just our government, but us, through what we consume and where we put our money and how we interact with each other on a daily basis, we are exacerbating the situation. We are fueling the situation. What do we do? How do we take ourselves out of that situation, and how do we fix it? And I think it's been a long process for me since there, trying to understand more of what I participate in every day when I buy my coffee or my tomato, what that means. And I think I'm still sort of at the beginning of that process, which I'm sure will be a lifelong endeavor. But the more that we search and learn and try to understand what system we're a part of, the more we become repulsed at our own participants, and the more we feel like we not only have an opportunity but an actual obligation to do something about it.
We found that there's so many different ways to act responsibly and to target this issue. Not complying in the system that perpetuates a lot of the reasons that people are forced to come to the United States. So, for instance, in addition to doing the work that's going across the border into Nogales, we found it's really important for us to, rather than buying products that were picked by farm workers here under conditions that are just inhumane, no one should ever have to live through, buying products that were produced by co-ops in Mexico, for instance, or rather than buying tomatoes that are picked in Florida, think about growing our own tomatoes and understanding what that process is like, how we can live in small actions in an everyday way to actually not comply in a system that we disagree with.
Right, I think that's really been really important for me and Jake while we're learning this, to see the smaller humanitarian and political situation and understand it within the broader context of our home, the Earth. I think that's really important that our lens be broader than just what's happening in Nogales or just what's happening with immigration, but rather who we want to be as a people, what relationship we want to have with the land, and how our policies are then man-made policies, our laws, our trade system, whatever it is, if those are really reflecting those ideals. And if they're not, how can we change them as a system, and also how can we change them as individuals?
Well, Jake and Elena, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Before we let you go, is there a website that No More Deaths has that our listeners could hook up to?
www.nomoredeaths.org. Incredible organization.
Well, thank you much. I know you guys plan to go back to the border, so we'll hope to get another update.
Thanks for having us.
Today we're going to speak with Azadeh Shahshahani. She's the director of the National Security Immigrants' Rights Project of the ACLU of Georgia. She's also a lawyer for our series, Lawyers You'll Like. The project she directs is aimed at bringing Georgia into compliance with international human rights and constitutional standards in its treatment of refugee and immigrant communities. This also includes extensive work, sadly, with immigrant detainees, of which there are thousands in Georgia. Azadeh also serves as the Executive Vice President and International Committee Co-Chair for the National Lawyers Guild. She's a specialist in immigrants, immigrants' rights, refugees, detention, and will particularly talk about the unholy merger of ICE, the Federal Immigration Authority, with local domestic police to round up and detain thousands of people in Georgia and elsewhere in the United States. Azadeh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do, because we want to introduce you to our listeners as one of the lawyers you'll like.
My name is Azadeh Shahshahani. I work on immigrants' rights and post-9/11 national security issues with the ACLU of Georgia. Currently, the focus areas for the project are immigration detention, 287G, and other forms of local enforcement.
What's 287G?
287G is an agreement between the federal government and localities that basically gives authorization to some, you know, police officers or sheriff deputies to start enforcing immigration laws. So basically, yeah, it turns local law enforcement into immigration officials.
Now, has that happened in Georgia already?
There are four counties right now in Georgia that have 287G, and it's been in place for the past 3 years. You know, these are counties with a long and documented history of racial discrimination and racial injustice, and the fact that the federal government has decided to give the local police, you know, an additional tool to go after communities of color and immigrant communities is deplorable.
Have you seen an increase in people picked up because of 287G?
Oh, definitely.
Can you tell us about that a little bit, and maybe about the detention issues?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers have, you know, gone up tremendously. I mean, just in one county, about 2,000 plus people in Cobb County getting, you know, picked up and processed through 287G.
Did you say the number 2,000? Is that what I heard?
Yes.
2,000 people have been picked up because of 287G?
They've been processed through 287G and, you know, deported.
What's their nationality generally?
Generally Latino. Uh-huh.
And how long do you think these people have been here? What are they doing here? You got a kind of an average profile of these people who have been ripped off and deported?
A lot of people who are, you know, in Cobb County or Gwinnett, you know, do have ties to the community. You know, they have, you know, U.S. citizen spouses or children. I mean, in terms of occupation, doing different types of jobs. So, you know, it's definitely had a very detrimental impact on the community. And the ACLU of Georgia has actually documented the impact of 287G on the communities in Cobb and Gwinnett. There are a couple of reports that they published in the past year that were based on interviews with community members and, you know, their spouses, and also with, you know, advocates and attorneys in Cobb and Gwinnett.
Right.
Or two, yeah.
Okay. Terror and isolation in Cobb, how unchecked police power under federal law 287G has torn families apart and threatened public safety. And there's another one as well, the persistence of racial profiling in Gwinnett. Cobb, you had 2,000 people picked up. Other counties as well get picked up, I guess, for any reason, a broken headlight, and they get their information checked or whatever, and then they get taken where? What happens?
Right. So, I mean, just one thing. I mean, you mentioned, you know, broken headlight, and sometimes, you know, it's not even clear why people are being pulled over. You know, there's no moving violation noted on the ticket. The fact is there's, you know, very little oversight over the program and the way, you know, police officers and the counties are implementing it either at the federal level or at the state level. You know, Georgia doesn't have an anti-racial profiling law in the books, so there's no way to hold the police accountable. They're not, you know, collecting the data on who all they're, you know, who all they're stopping. Basically, after a person, you know, goes to the jail and, you know, the 287G officers determine that this person, you know, may be undocumented and, you know, start deportation proceedings. And then ICE comes and picks them up, takes them to one of the now four immigration detention centers in Georgia. We unfortunately just about a few weeks ago had a new one open in Ocala, which is as remote as it gets, more than three hours from Atlanta.
Wow. Now, are these run by private or public corporations or companies? Who runs these prisons?
It's a mix, and it's, you know, really illustrative of the pattern of the immigration detention centers around the country. Some are run by the federal government. Actually, you know, very few of them are totally run by the federal government, solely run by the federal government. But others are run by counties, so, you know, jails. Others are run by private corporations. So in Georgia, out of the four facilities, you have two that are operated by the Corrections Corporation of America, and then you have one that's City of Atlanta Jail that basically, you know, rents some space to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And then this new facility, where, you know, we're still trying to figure out how it's, you know, operating, but it's basically a jail. And our understanding is that now, you know, a corporation has come in, the Detention Management Corporation, that's going to be responsible for the detention of the immigrant detainees. And, you know, already 100 women have been transferred there.
So these people get picked up. How long do they spend in these detention facilities and what happens to them?
It really varies. It depends on whether they want to fight their deportation or whether, you know, the government has, you know, coerced them to sign a voluntary departure to basically, you know, sign away the rights to a hearing. So, you know, in the best of circumstances, I would say a couple of months. But there are people who have been detained for more than a year because, you know, they do have a case, they're fighting it, and the government refuses to grant bond. People are just sitting in detention.
We've interviewed recently two people who were on the Arizona-New Mexico border helping people who had been deported across into Mexico. They told us that people are picked up randomly, almost separated from their families, and just set across the border. This is a practice that's just recent, and it happens to people who are doing productive work here in the United States whose jobs are not going to be taken by American citizens, jobs that Americans don't even want. And the whole system seemed to be not only cruel, but irrational.
Yeah. You know, the Obama administration boasted that in the past year, they have deported 400,000 people.
Which is higher than the Bush administration, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, their claim was they were doing it, they said, because they wanted to, like, show the Republicans they could be tough and then get the DREAM Act through or something like that. Is that what you've heard?
Exactly. And, you know, obviously we haven't seen anything on the relief side. It's all been enforcement.
Is it conceivable that some of the clients that you both represent, as well as some of these people put into these prisons all over Georgia, wind up at the border, at the place where the last people we interviewed on this subject, which is Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico, do some get deported through there that you know of?
The Stewart Detention Center, which is the largest one in Georgia and in the United States, is, you know, 1,700 plus. Actually, now I think it's 1,900 immigrants are being detained there, and they're just basically taken from the facility and left at the border. I mean, we had a case recently that we filed on behalf of a U.S. citizen born and raised in North Carolina. You know, Mark Little, he has mental disabilities, and you know, a prison official in North Carolina. You know, he was there to serve a short sentence. They determined that he's not who he says he is. He's not an American citizen. You know, with the name of Mark Little, rather he's Mexican, and his name is Jose Thomas. And it's just, you know, Kafkaesque what happened to him. So, you know, he went through the deportation process all the while, continuing with his claim that, you know, look, I am a U.S. citizen, and nobody believing him and, you know, refusing to provide him with counsel, even though, you know, the government was aware of his mental disabilities and there was ample evidence to suggest that he is, in fact, a U.S. citizen. He was detained at the Stewart Detention Center for 6 weeks, and then he was, you know, picked up and left at the border, you know, still in his prison jumpsuit, and basically was left on his own devices and made to find his way around. And you know, he spoke no word of Spanish, so for 4 months he was walking around and, you know, living off of begging and in shelters, and finally he made his way to a U.S. embassy in Guatemala, and, you know, finally somebody listened to what he had to say, and they contacted his family. You know, they sent him a U.S. passport.
Amazing. Now, you filed a lawsuit, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that lawsuit?
You know, we filed a lawsuit against ICE and, you know, various federal government officials, as well as in North Carolina and Georgia officials. We are obviously, you know, seeking damages to, you know, seek a measure of redress for the wrongs that he suffered, but also seeking to hold the government accountable and to put into place a system of safeguards to ensure that, you know, first of all, U.S. citizens aren't being deported and that people with mental disabilities are afforded a measure of due process.
What are the conditions like in those prisons? Have you been able to do anything about that?
Right. So actually a coalition that, you know, we are involved with called Georgia Detention Watch, we published a report on the conditions at the Stewart Detention Center. The report came out a couple of years ago, April of 2009. The report was based on interviews with the detainees at the Stewart Detention Center. You know, there were a range of complaints, you know, from hygiene conditions, 16 men per one toilet, to lack of adequate interpretation. There were, you know, very few guards who were, you know, proficient in Spanish. There are also no contact visits at Stewart. So, you know, if you are a family member of a detainee at Stewart and, you know, you travel 6 hours from North Carolina to be allowed to visit with your family member for 1 hour per week, you can't even touch them or hold their hands. You know, you have to look at them, you know, from behind the glass.
No, it's amazing because these people haven't been convicted of any crime or anything. It's incredible to me, actually. A lot of them have been living here forever. You're the National Security Immigrants Rights Project Director for the ACLU in Georgia. What are you doing there? I mean, were you born in Georgia? What are you doing this kind of work? How did you get involved?
Well, I'm actually from Iran.
I guess I knew that. So
right.
How did you get from Iran to Georgia, of all places, and doing the kind of work you're doing?
Right, you know, I came to the U.S. when I was 16. You know, I went to college and law school in Michigan. And then after law school, you know, I knew that I wanted to do human rights work. So I was married, and my husband actually is an academic. So he landed a job in North Carolina with North Carolina State. And so, you know, I had no connections to North Carolina. There weren't a whole lot of, you know, opportunities available for the kind of work I wanted to do. But then, you know, this was in 2004. The post-9/11 anti-Muslim hysteria was still running pretty high. And I was looking around for some type of a project or organization that would cater to the needs of this community. And I didn't find anything. So I approached the ACLU of North Carolina and I proposed a project, basically focusing on empowerment, doing Know Your Rights presentations at the mosques, also putting together an anti-racial profiling campaign. You know, so I was doing that work for a couple of years, and then we ended up moving to Georgia and came on board as the interim legal director. But then, you know, my heart was still with this kind of work. So I basically, you know, proposed a project focusing on, you know, national security and immigrants' rights, and the project is started in March of 2008. It's definitely great need.
Your work in Georgia just sounds incredible. Are there any last comments or things you can tell people to do here? Is there a website that they can find out more? What would you suggest?
Well, people can always, you know, visit our website, aclugA.org, to find out about, you know, the kinds of cases and issues we're working on. The website for our coalition, Georgia Detention Watch, is georgiadetentionwatch.com.
Well, that's great. Adida, your work just sounds amazing. So thank you very much, and you're definitely a lawyer we like.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.